Hello, everyone. I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 7 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we are recording in Nam, Melbourne on Wurundjeri land, and we have a guest who has been bitten so hard by the research bug that he is writing not one, but two volumes of biography based on the extensive archival treasures of his subject, the Australian author and literary intellectual Frank Morehouse. Dr. Matthew Lamb is a former editor and CEO of Review of Australian Fiction and Island Magazines, based in Tasmania. Apart from his mammoth Morehouse project, for which Matthew was the recipient of a prestigious Hazel Rowley Fellowship, he also writes the Public Things newsletter, offering broad discussions about ideas and intellectual history regarding literary culture and democracy. These Public Things. This includes occasional pieces on the life and works of Frank Morehouse, also outtakes from the Biography Project, and reflections on the art of biography writing, archives, publishing media, politics, and other topics that also interested and occupied the critical imagination of Frank Morehouse. Matthew has two PhDs in literature and philosophy, respectively. And he's an honorary research fellow in the School of Historical and Philosophical Inquiry at the University of Queensland. Now, the first volume of Matthew's biography of Morehouse, Strange Paths, was published in late 2023 by Penguin, and it was shortlisted for the Age Book of the Year Awards in 2024. And we'll come to discuss that epic book later, but first, welcome to Archives Anonymous, Matthew.
Thank you.
You've come to a safe space.
Thank you for having me. That's actually the first time anyone's referred to me as Dr. Matthew Lamb.
You've got two PhDs, so I suppose I should have introduced you as Dr. Lamb.
No, it's okay.
But anybody who's gone back for two bites of that doctoral cherry must have a very severe archive addiction. Let's start by asking, when did you first get bitten by the research bug?
So I've been thinking about this, and there's two related moments, and they're seemingly unrelated, but in my mind they're related and they kind of happened around the same time and they reinforced each other. So this is in the early 90s and a little bit before the internet became a thing. The first one is one of my probably longest held intellectual obsessions is the work of Albert Camus. And there's a conventional view of Albert Camus, which you're probably thinking of right now, which is actually, I would argue, wrong. But when I first encountered Camus in the early 90s, you know, when you're at that age where you're reading stuff that you think you should be reading because everyone else is reading and you're discovering it for the first time. I read through his work. I understood the conventional view. I thought it was okay, but not interesting enough to continue with. And then I just moved on. And it was 2 or 3 years later, I was in Brisbane. Coincidentally, for the purposes of the podcast, it was in Archives Secondhand Bookshop. And I stumbled across Camus' notebooks. His first volume was notebooks from 1935 to 1942. Even though I had read a lot at this stage, I had never read things like, you know, posthumously published notebooks and stuff. And this is stuff that we'd associate now with what you'd find in an archive, like unpublished works, letters, and that type of thing. I'd never really considered reading an author's notebooks. And so I picked it up, and just standing there in the shop, what I was reading didn't tally with the conventional view that I already had. And so I bought it, and that's kind of kicked off a long-standing obsession with Camus. But what I learned from that in that moment was that no matter what you think you may know about something that you read, there's always going to be something else that you read behind it or hidden somewhere that can completely change your view of what the main thing is or what you think the thing is. And so that kind of kicked off, I think, me digging in further and further to those behind the scenes, even without physically setting foot in an archive at this point, a traditional archive. I started reading notes and letters and stuff. And then around the same time, I was doing my honours thesis on Samuel Beckett, the Irish writer, and I discovered that there was an archive of some of his stuff, weirdly enough, at Dartmouth College in the United States. And they sent me a list of what they had, and I had a look through the list. And there were two items that I requested, and then they copied them and posted them to me. And one of them was Samuel Beckett's first collection of stories. It was in the 1930s, called More Pricks Than Kicks. And in the published version, all the stories are about a character named Bellacqua. And in the published version, Bellacqua dies in the final story. And this was an additional story that was left out of the published version. And in it, Bellacqua rises from the dead, which kind of indicates that he was kind of like a Christ figure. And of course, that just changes the entire meaning, much like the Camus experience, the entire meaning of the rest of the book. And at the same time, the other item I got from them was a recording of Samuel Beckett. So in the 50s, he wrote Crap's Last Tape, the play with, you know, a reel-to-reel tape, much less sophisticated than what we're sitting here today. And it was him sitting at a reel-to-reel recorder in his home, playing with the equipment, trying to work out what it was. And he was, unlike, you know, we have a producer here today who's making us sit the right distance. He didn't understand anything. So he's really close to the mic. It's popping. His Irish accent is lisping a bit. And he's reading one of his poems, and he gets so frustrated that at the end of it, just as he's turning off the machine in frustration, he says, and I'm not going to do an Irish accent, but he goes, fuck it. So the short answer to the longer question was, I think, just hearing Samuel Beckett say, fuck it.
You were hooked.
I hooked, and that's the feeling I wanted to kind of keep finding in archives, those moments.
Because it gave you a sense of stepping behind the curtain.
Yeah, and also it's like, there are real people behind here doing real, well, just the fact that Samuel Beckett would actually go through the experience of how does this contraption work, this reel-to-reel tape recorder, and then kind of from that come up with an idea of a play and write it. You know, that's the kind of stuff I'm interested in reconstructing. The creative process behind things.
So was this awakening that you had in the bookshop and later with that Beckett tape, was that a kind of crisis of faith for you? Like a there's no such thing as Santa Claus kind of moment?
No, but it did make me start to question what I was being taught in university. You get presented with conventional views of things. Most people just accept that and then they just repeat that over and over. And then to the next generation, then repeat it. Like there's errors that, you know, I won't turn this into a podcast about Camus, but there's errors that like happened in the 50s that like are repeated now and people just say it. And like, there's just no, you know, read a book. So yeah, so it kind of just made me keep thinking. But also then it's kind of a humbling thing too, because even though I think that I can go behind the scenes and discover something new that gives me a new reading of something, I can never then fully get to the point where I go, but this is the true reading or this is the true answer. You kind of go, no, there's got to be something somewhere that, well, I think you get closer, you come to a more adequate reading or interpretation of the world or a person in the world through the archive process.
So to throw another intellectual giant into the mix kind of gave you the encouragement to live the questions,
yeah,
as Rilke.
Definitely. I mean, there's that line from James Baldwin, which I'm going to butcher because he's obviously more eloquent, but it's like the purpose of the artist is to find the question beneath every answer. And then that just keeps going back. It's turtles all the way down.
So you said that that moment where you heard Samuel Beckett say, fuck it, the word you used before, that was it, you felt something then. How do you experience archive fever? What does it feel like for you when you are in that grip of that search or that quest?
Now, I know this is illusory, but it kind of removes any sense of intermediation. You kind of feel like you're more immediately connected physically to someone, like having a conversation with them, even though you know that there's layers of mediation and, you know, often decades or centuries between you. You kind of get that feeling, like even with Frank. I mean, Frank died in 2022. And I keep forgetting that he's passed. I'm like, he's alive in whatever the moment is that I happen to be dealing with that. And I was actually in a conversation with some friends the other day about how I'm trying to work out how I'm going to handle writing about his death. And they thought, hasn't he already died? Like, no, no, he has, just not yet in the book. And I know it's illusory and false, but you know, you get that sense of, yeah.
We'll get to Frank and particularly his death later on in the interview, but let's start at the beginning with Frank. So for people who might not know who Frank is, Frank Morehouse was a titan of Australian literature and letters and our cultural life more generally. He was an activist, an intellectual, a novelist, a screenwriter, a journalist, an advocate against censorship and for copyright.
He was an unashamed libertarian, an avowed feminist, a gay liberationist, and a champion of Indigenous land rights. His output was really huge and varied, and it ranged from books, the famed Edith trilogy, which I've only recently gotten onto. I don't know why it's taken me so long. He wrote essays and scripts and short stories and journalistic articles, and he recorded everything, his work processes, his relationships with lovers and friends, his inner world. He's a man that I guess can truly be said to have an archived life. I'm wondering by which of these many avenues, these many paths, did you first encounter Frank?
I was always aware of Frank, and I was never going to write a biography of anyone. I never thought, but I do kind of think biographically when I think about people, you know, how the order of their life. I met him in 2012 when he judged the Josephine Ulrich short story prize that I happened to win that year. So I obviously knew he had good taste. I think the prize went on for a few more years, but there was talk that that was going to be the last year. So they bundled all the prize money into the one prize. So I ended up winning $20,000 for a short story, my first short story that I'd written, which kind of then ruins anything that you do afterwards. And that night we got drunk. It was in the Gold Coast. I was going to take Frank and we were going to go put the 20 grand on black and double it. My girlfriend had to intervene and take the check away. And so we kind of got on quite well. And then I used the money to then establish an online literary journal called Review of Australian Fiction. So most of the money went to paying other authors.
You really are a nerd, aren't you?
God, I wish I had the money now. It was kind of that. And it was actually that kind of thing that it was more what Frank did in the behind the scenes, that when we started talking, everyone knows about the copyright case in 74. But there's other court cases afterwards, including one in the late 70s when he was approached by an archive to buy some of his stuff. And he said, okay, I need my manuscripts back. Ask the publisher, can I have the manuscript back? And they said, oh, we don't know where it is. And he said, well, it's mine. They go, well, it's not yours. You gave it to us. And then there had to be a court case when he sued his publisher about who owns manuscripts. And it turns out the author owns the manuscripts. So the very fact that many authors today in Australia are able to claim ownership over their manuscripts that they submit to the publishers is because of Frank Morehouse, but nobody knows that. So there's court cases like this all the way through. It's very litigious, including ones that often didn't get to court, but just the threat of a change thing. So in the 90s, for the first Edith Campbell book, he was deemed ineligible for the Miles Franklin because it was considered not Australian enough. And he had like a legal brief written. He was going to sue because they said, we can't change the rules unless you contest Miles Franklin's will. And that's what he attempted to do. And then they then opened it up and, you know, the Miles Franklin. I'm sure if we went through the Miles Franklin.
Extraordinary story.
I'm sure if we went through the Miles Franklin over the last 30 years and saw the types of books that are now getting the prize that may not be considered Australian enough, it's because of Frank.
And it's also kind of ironic given that Miles Franklin herself did live overseas
this is my
for so much
point.
Of her life
this is
and
my
was
whole
a
point.
Really transnational figure.
Yes, yeah. And was involved in like, not directly involved with the League of Nations, but involved with, you know, feminist groups.
Oh, totally. Like, she was similar to Edith Campbell in many ways.
I was going to say, it's hard to imagine
this
somebody
exactly
that Stella
point.
Miles Franklin would have admired more than Edith Campbell Berry, the character in the Edith trilogy.
And so that's just an example, but there was just all the more behind-the-scenes stuff, and I was talking to Frank, and this is the stuff people tend not to realise that people do. I keep saying that writers in Australia are unique in the world in that we have to constantly recreate the conditions within which we write while at the same time trying to actually get the writing done. And Frank was one of the people that did that for everyone.
So you met Frank on the Gold Coast, didn't bet your winnings, but did go on in some ways with some legacy from Frank on your other aspects of your own personal career and your editing work. When did you decide to get involved in a Frank Morehouse project? Like, how was your archival interest sparked?
That's the bit I don't really know. Frank's very good at playing people. And I think he played me, and I'm not sure how it happened. Elsewhere, I've referred to myself as an accidental biographer because I didn't really think I was going to do it.
He bet his winnings on you.
He did. I was just talking to him about stuff. I'd keep going, oh, that's really interesting. People need to know more about that. And he goes, yes, they should, shouldn't they? And then I go, I might have a look in the archive just to see what's there and dug up some stuff. I go, this is interesting. I could have just written a book of literary criticism about his books, or I could have just written a book about some of the more legal stuff that he's done in the back. But there's so much stuff in his life that the only way to really do justice to it is to see how it's all intertwined. And the only way to do that is a biography, which I'd never thought of doing. And so I did. And then it just crept up on me.
So tell us about the extent of the Morehouse archives themselves. Like, where are they? What's in them? Are we talking about everything's in one room in one place? Or?
No. So when I talk about the Morehouse archives, the main collection is at the Fryer Library at the University of Queensland. And that contains, you know, over 200 boxes. And that's most of the stuff from the 1970s onwards. Just in context for people, Frank was born in 1938 and died in 2022. Before that, he had started putting his archive stuff into the National Library of Australia. And so they have stuff from the 1950s up to and including his first published book. And that was more the kind of literary papers. And then later on, for that period, the more personal and private papers are at the Fryer. So it's kind of spread out amongst those two libraries. But then there's the people associated with Frank. So a lot of that stuff's in the State Library of New South Wales, because that was where he spent most of his time, is in New South Wales. So people like Don Anderson and Michael Wilding and Donald Horne, all their papers are there. And then there's just the peripheral stuff, like his family had some archival material, the family history. Frank had a lot of stuff that he hadn't given the archives that he gave me. The two things that I really liked during the project was how, as you would have this experience yourself, other researchers are just very generous with sharing their own private material. So I don't know if you recall, Anne Coombs wrote the history of the Sydney Push. When was that? Early 90s was it published, I think? And so throughout the mid to late 80s, she recorded a lot of interviews with a lot of the main players. And when I read that book and saw she referenced having done interviews, I contacted her and she just kind of made available to me all of the interviews, which was great. And then that's one extreme from like a writer and published author who gave me some of their material. But on the other extreme, there was a reference to one of Frank's letters to him writing a student newsletter at Wollongong Technical College in the 1950s that's not in his archive. And so I contacted, which was, I think, had then become the Wollongong High School, and said, do you have any papers? And then a wonderful library assistant, and we do love our library assistants.
You do.
I know, because I am one, dug around and found for me not only the newsletter, but the fact that it contained the earliest existing Frank Morehouse short story when he was 13 years old, as well as like an essay he wrote about the history of publishing.
And that would have made her as happy as it made you.
So when I think of the archives, there's the main institutional archives, and then obviously it spills out.
So it sounds like Frank essentially kind of anointed you to be his biographer, or
I don't know.
Well, at least, you know, participated in the in the process.
Certainly did. He arranged the meeting. We had dinner.
How did that relationship kind of shape your relationship to the archive? The sense that you had a personal relationship with the subject you were writing.
It was authorized in the sense that it gave me access to everything and wrote the letters saying that I can copy and access everything, including restricted material. And that's continued now with his estate after his death. Mm. I have access to everything, including, by the way, after his death, another 15 boxes were delivered to the archive. And this is kind of in a limbo zone where they hadn't yet been accessioned. They were basically just his house was cleaned up and thrown in boxes and sent to Fryer. And I was given permission to go through those. And that contained stuff that he probably wouldn't have wanted in an archive. But it was interesting, and it helped kind of confirm a lot of the stuff that I'd done. And this was already in process, this volume one, but it helped me go back and just confirm some things.
Did you feel in any kind of ethical conundrum?
Oh, yeah, there always is. And I just use it to confirm rather than to cite, there's stuff in there that, you know, we all have stuff that you don't want sent to a library.
So is it in the library now?
I don't know if it's been accessioned. I don't know if they've gotten around to it yet. But, I mean, that they're aware of the issues around with Frank and then what to put in and what not to put in.
So let's just stay on that for a moment. That sounds like it's a controversial aspect of the collection itself. I'm interested to know, like, often as history lecturers or PhD supervisors, even I would say to our students that the role of you as the researcher is to set a critical line of inquiry and then work out where you can go to answer those questions. And then, here's the phrase, listen to the archives. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how a researcher like yourself listens to the archives when they also have the living subject prattling away in their ear, but then also being aware of, because you know the person, what their sensitivities or what their blind spots might be about how you might and whether you even are able to expose those. Mm.
It's a big question. Frank compartmentalized his life, and certain parts of his life, even though they may have been known publicly, were kind of not known to individuals within his life. And a couple of moments that really struck home. One was when we had lunch one day and we were talking about the biography, and he was saying, whatever you do, make it salacious. Make it the most salacious biography, like, you know, because he wants to have this public image of being hedonistic and, you know, having all these sexual partners and having just this great time. And then a month or two later, when I'd found out more about his cross-dressing, and I was talking to him about it, and he actually just let drop in the conversation that he, at that point, spent two-thirds of his life dressed as a woman, mainly in his apartment in King's Cross. And I was just asking about what the parameters of that were, like, you know, do you talk to people, do you go outside, you know, this is King's Cross, you've lived your life, it's a pretty comfortable place for you, you know, would you go to the corner shop? And he just really shut down and waved his arm. I'm not going to do it because I'll hit the microphone. He always waves his arm in this particular way to kind of like shut things down, go, this is not for conversation. And I was like, well, that's interesting, because he obviously wants to present one way, but then there's something that's blocking him. And so that kind of became the conundrum in his life. So the way I see it is he made all this material available because he wanted this stuff told, but he couldn't say it himself. But that also then puts too much pressure on me. So how much do I say? I say what I can to paint a picture. I don't think you need to go into all the details, like this photo, this thing. Is this something that he wanted? This is not something he wanted made public, therefore, you know.
Well, that's really the paradox of Frank's sexuality, isn't it? I mean, he spent a lifetime decrying censorship and the policing of sexuality, but then, as you say, was intensely private and seemingly conflicted about his own sexual and gender identity. You wrote in an article in The Conversation that he tried to hide from the public while in public. I'm wondering whether there's anything that you might have expected to find in the archives that wasn't there. Like, how do you read the silences in the unpublished record? And then I suppose the second part of that is can you be public advocate of an issue while being very privately conflicted? And then where does that come in your biographing of the person? How do you interpret that?
Yeah. So the conflict with Frank, the way I've interpreted it, looking through and at a really granular level, how he acted in particular situations and his overall view, is in terms of his identities, he didn't use identity language like we do today. He always used what he would say, things like he'd refer to like my bisexuality. He wouldn't say I'm a bisexual. He'd talk about my transvestism. He wouldn't say I'm a transvestite. But also the terms changed as the language changed over the years. So in the 60s, he may refer to himself as being camp. In the 80s, he might refer to himself as being transvestite. I think in the 90s, there was a period when he actually was wondering whether or not he was transsexual. You know, so things changed. So instead of just saying Frank was one thing, I tried to map the different things that Frank thought he was over the time. I thought that was the most honest way to do that. And the way I interpreted that is that in terms of his public pronouncements on being open and against censorship and free expression, is Frank didn't actually ultimately know who or what he was. And what he wanted was the type of world in which somebody could find that out.
On that question of, I suppose, the complexities of talking about someone's gender and sexuality in a historical sense, I'm really interested in to what extent we can claim someone like Frank in a sort of queer or even trans lineage. Because as I'm sure you know, Matthew, queer and trans people in the present are really hungry for a sense of history and lineage, and there's a kind of political imperative to show that people like us have always been here. What are your thoughts about that in terms of someone like Frank? Do you think he can be read as a kind of proto-trans figure, or is that going too far?
I wouldn't pin him down to any one thing, but I think he's living the question throughout. Because I took that very seriously, that it's just because it's a biography of an individual, there's still a broader public responsibility. So, for example, as we were saying before about that contradiction between Frank wanting the biography to be salacious but also not wanting to talk about certain things, So, for example, with this relationship that is in the biography with this older man that started when he was 17 and lasted for 50 years, when he started talking about that relationship later in his life and in his communications with me, he was adamant that he was the one who initiated. He'd go like, I seduced him, because that's part of the hedonistic self-image. But when you go back to the actual material, it was the complete opposite. And not only that, but it was fraught and freighted with kind of an internalized homophobia. And I thought it was a more honest story for the history of sexuality in Australia to tell the truth that Frank may have had same-sex attractions as a teenager, but then when it came time to acting upon them, there was a whole social convention thing that was actually also making it really fraught and upsetting and difficult for him to do. And that's why he was always opposed to convention. And those moments throughout the story, I think they had to be told just because of that greater responsibility. And this isn't just in terms of Frank's identities, but also just in terms of the literature itself or the other events. I tried to write the biography in such a way that leaves me out and my judgment out as much as possible so that anybody can come in and read it and pull out of it what they need. So somebody can come in and go, well, yes, Frank is part of Australian queer history. Here's the thread that I can pick up on.
Yeah, so you're doing a kind of show, don't tell approach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm interested in taking Eve's idea further there of being able to read into somebody in the past who's had a long and storied and archived life, but applying contemporary labels or diagnoses. And the one I'm thinking of in particular at the moment is neurodiversity, which is something that is getting a lot more attention now. Certainly a lot of adults are receiving their own ADHD or autism diagnoses. Often when they've gone to get their children diagnosed, they realize for themselves. It struck me in reading your biography of Frank, it's possible that Frank was neurodiverse and that, you know, your book is called Strange Paths, that his brain might have worked on strange or at the very least non-neuronormative paths. Is that another area, another place that we might start to go to in work like you're doing as a researcher, so that people in the neurodiverse community also historically can start to look for people who might be role models or might show them ways to live? How might you as a biographer think about some of those more contemporary scientific or diagnostic tools for understanding somebody's life?
I mean, it's possible, but I'm really careful throughout the book not to really diagnose him with anything.
It's a harsh word. I shouldn't have used that word.
It's actually really good, but I think that's the challenge that Frank had all throughout his life, was he didn't know. And even things like his father had suffered with some form of depression and anxiety, but he dealt with it by being really efficient and just working hard and throwing all of his energy into the agricultural business and into public service, never having a moment to himself, so he didn't have to sit with himself. He was always busy, and that's what they try to drive into the children. And so Frank also suffered from a very young age some form of depression and anxiety. But Frank himself didn't seem to associate it until the 80s as being possibly genetic, because Frank's grandfather, as I point out in the first chapter,
which is a great first chapter, that prehistory of Frank Morehouse is kaleidoscopic, but quite fascinating.
His grandfather committed suicide, but his father didn't know that until the late 70s. He just thought, because he was only about 6 years old at the time, he just thought that his father had died. So Frank's father didn't know until the 70s, and he was ashamed, and he didn't tell Frank until the 80s. So Frank was only in his 50s. So this is kind of information that maybe if you knew it earlier, because all of his depression and anxiety from his teenage years onwards, he was personally associating with his sexuality and gender, not the fact that he just may be genetically predisposed to depression. Again, and I don't know how much any of this is true, so I don't really lay any of this out. I just lay out the story as it's happening, but also Frank's self-interpretation or his own self-understanding at every point, because he changes his own self-understanding. So I don't know if you could say he was neurodiverse. Sometimes when I look at the types of relationships he had with women versus the type of relationships he had with men, sometimes I come down the side that he was just homosexual. He didn't seem to have that satisfying sexual relationships with women and had problems with impotency and so on. Any references he has to his relationships with men is just pure joy. And sometimes he even renounced his homosexuality and used language like, you know, I had homosexual streams in my life, but that's now over. even though at the time it wasn't. So if he doesn't know, I would be very uncomfortable placing a label of any sort upon him. I just know him as Frank.
I want to ask also about the question of censorship. Mm. One of the things I really loved most about the biography is the way you paint a really vivid portrait of just how much kind of regimes of censorship shaped Australian literature across the 20th century. You know, the banning of books from overseas, but also local writers having their work censored prior to publication. And I guess that got me thinking about the way censorship can be internalized, that if Australian writers knew they couldn't write or publish under certain topics or use certain words, that they didn't even try. Do you think we can sort of think about a sort of ghost or hidden archive of all the works that might have been written but weren't?
Yes, no, very much so. That's actually exactly something I thought of. And I've also thought a lot about, not that I have the time or the energy to do it, but I'd really like to explore the history of a lot of people left the country, expatriates, and everyone thinks it's because like, hey, it's cool, we're going overseas. It's like they kind of had to go overseas precisely because they couldn't write what they wanted to write here. And then there's other people who stayed here and struggled and couldn't get published what they wanted to write. So yes, I think there is definitely a history that can be written there, or there is an archive of that unrealized. Because that's one of the things I find really interesting in any writer's life is the abandoned or unrealized works, or the works that, that's one thing right from the beginning I wanted to kind of avoid, is there's this conventional model for a literary biography where a person has an idea for a book, they write the book, it gets published. They have an idea for another book, they write it, it gets published. And it's like, that's not actually how it goes. You actually have 10 ideas. You take a couple of them one direction, then they sit there, and then you work on a book, and then that gets published. And then kind of down the line, you might write a book 20 years later that's based on ideas that you had like, you know, 30 years earlier. And that's what Frank did. So even though the book is very strictly chronological, at any point, it's very nonlinear. The possibilities that could have happened next, what could have happened next at any point. Even, and this is more for the second volume, but it ends this volume. It's in 1975 that the first reference to him thinking about the League of Nations comes in, but that book's non-published until 1993.
You've said just before that you just think of him as Frank, but you've also made it very clear that Frank was a very contradictory figure. There are many Franks. There's not the one Frank. You've called Morehouse a protean figure. Mm. I actually went scrambling to my thesaurus to make sure that my understanding of protean was what you meant. And I got ever-changing, variable, mutable, kaleidoscopic, erratic, quicksilver, inconsistent, unstable, unsteady, unsettled, fluid, fluctuating, all great words. I'm wondering whether you can read the shifts and feints and prevarications and denials and incongruities in Frank as also a wider manifestation of the social history which Frank himself not only documented as a writer and journalist, but also lived as a person. His own personal journey does not occur in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And, you know, did he become more open about his sexuality once it was decriminalized or after the end of the AIDS crisis? How did you slice history?
Yeah, and that's why I call it a cultural biography. When I started it, it occurred to me, even though I've read many biographies, the moment I sat down to write it, I realized, I don't know how to write this. How the hell do you do it? I actually vividly remember the first day, you know, when you go like, this is the day I start writing. I sat down, I'm like, what?
You opened the Word document. Yeah. You're like, what next?
Yeah, how do you do it? So the first principle I came to after I thought about it was that the narrative shape of the biography should in some sense be proportionate to the shape of the subject, which sounds really obvious, but their way of thinking about the world and their own self-understanding of the world. And for Frank, he never put himself at the center. He was always took a detached, dissented view of whatever situation he was in and then tried to understand what the cultural history or the context was before he even came onto the scene. And so that then became the model for the book. And he does that throughout, and there's little snippets of him seeing him doing it throughout, which I hope an attentive reader will go, oh, this is what Matt's doing. I found it really hard to actually write about Frank and putting him at the center, precisely because the way he thought about the world was he was always thinking about these other things that were happening around him. So yes, very much where it fits in. And this is again why the chronology helped, because things like, and this is also the contradictory stuff. So even though he didn't talk about his own sexuality much, he was still publishing short stories with homosexual characters, which itself would have been censored. during the censorship regime. But the other thing, I'm also interested in media ecology and the fact that we now think everything's available to everyone at all times because of the internet. But of course, back then, if you publish something in a student newsletter, chances are a very small audience will see it. And he actually understood this. So he would say something in Thor or Thorunka, one of the student newspapers. So he actually admitted to having homosexual relations at a time when it was illegal in the student newspaper because he knew that his parents wouldn't read it. There was an example I used, and that showed us how he understood the different levels of society was, and I can't remember now the author's name, who wrote The Myth of the Female Orgasm?
Oh, yeah, that woman.
He wrote a review of that.
Yeah.
And there's three versions of it, his review. One he wrote for the Bulletin, which he knew his parents would read, and the general mainstream public. There was a broader review that he wrote for, I think it was Thor at the time, or one of the student, because it kept changing its name, one of the student newsletters, which expanded the view, and it was in there that he included that he himself had homosexual relations. And then there was another version that he wrote, which was not published, which was an appendix, and that's when he started talking about his gender identity dysphoria. So you could tell even then he's kind of like, okay, I'll say this, but this bit I won't say. The first time he mentions, and even this is one of the very few times he actually says, like, I'm a transvestite and not my transvestism. It's a student interview in the mid-80s, and it's just this long interview. The transcript is handwritten, and just in the middle of it, there's just Frank saying, oh, yeah, and I'm a transvestite. He knew what the audience was at the time and how it was situated at where he was in his life and what he was comfortable saying. So that's why the chronology was a really helpful way of organising that.
As you've suggested, Frank was a researcher himself, obviously, not just a biographical subject, and particularly the Edith trilogy and the whole history of the League of Nations involved enormous amounts of archival research on his own. But you've written about how Frank gave a talk in 1975, which he discussed the balancing of what he called the historical element with the narrative element. And you found in his notes later for that talk that he said, when the facts conflict with the legend, print the legend. But you've done the opposite in your book, as you've told us, in going back as a biographer and looking through the archive. When the facts contradict the legend, you have printed the facts, even if they contradict what Frank himself has said.
And also if they're boring. Often the legend is more interesting. And this isn't even just related to Frank, but something like, you know, there's the story with Donald Horne when he took over the editorship of the Bulletin with the Australia for the White Man was the masthead of the Bulletin. And he took the lead type, and the legend is he then had it melted. And I had written that in because I'd assumed that because there's the section with Donald Horne taking over the Bulletin. But then, of course, my brain kicked on and said, no, I can't. I checked, I asked around, I talked to Ryan Cropp, who was writing a biography of Donald Horne at the time. It hadn't yet come out at that point. And he was like, no, there's no evidence that that happened. We know that the masthead was taken off, but the second bit. So I just removed that line. Now, it's a small point, but that's the way I think, and I think historians and researchers would think.
In that process of correcting legends with facts or even just deleting them like that, did Frank resent having his memories corrected by you, the pesky, pedantic historian?
Actually, no. Well, firstly, the line I think I point out later in that essay, even though he references that line about, what is it, printing the...
When the facts conflict with the legend, print the legend.
Yeah. So we know that that was in his notes, but we don't know what meaning he gave to them when he gave that talk. We don't know if he read the line out and said, this is what I do, or this is not what I do. Or, you know, we don't know. We just know that he had that line. Because he knew that I had access to the archive. He knew I'd copied large sections of it, so I had it available with me in Tasmania. He would contact me as his memory bank and just go, can you just check? Did this happen here? Or am I? And I go, yes, no, this happened. That's true. Or he'd let slip something and go, did this happen? And I go, I've got no evidence of that happening. Nor Frank, what are you talking about? And he'd go, oh, no, nothing. Yeah, he used me to correct his own memories. He would play with the facts when it came to his own life, and that was that protective shield, and that would change over time. But he was always sure he was as accurate as possible when talking about the facts of other people's lives and of the world. So
he made shit up about himself.
Yeah, exactly. That's an easy way of putting it. So with the League of Nations stuff, he spent the reason I think it took him so long is he, from the 1970s onwards, when he started doing archival research as the basis for writing fiction, he called going to the archives a fiction-finding mission instead of a fact-finding mission. He would make sure that he was accurate. He wasn't going to lie or change something to fit the story. He'd want to make the story as accurate as possible. But he spent a long time working out how to do that. And, you know, other people who use historical references and literature may not do that, but Frank did.
So I guess that's a neat segue to what will have to be the last question, because we're running out of time. But Frank died only a year before Strange Paths was published. Apart from the personal loss of a friend that you must have grieved and may still be grieving, did his passing feel like a boon or a blow to your projected volume two? Like, I'm wondering whether there might be ways in which you feel freer writing the second volume now that your subject isn't around to...
No. I mean, I'd never be influenced by anything he'd wanted anyway. I'm pretty self-possessed in that way. I'm just sorry that you didn't get to read it. I think towards the end he was dreading reading it, but the people who have read it, his friends that have read it, have liked it in that it helps put things in context. I think it would have helped it would have helped himself put his own life in context. So, for example, towards the end of his life, one of the last times we met, because he always thought he had this fraught relationship with his brothers, a lot of sibling rivalry. He was the youngest. The next brother up, Arthur, was 6 years older, and then Owen was 10 years older. So you can imagine when you're growing up with that age difference, how different your lives are at different points. And then, of course, in the middle bit, they all went away to boarding school. And so Frank, being a kid, didn't really understand what was going on. And I'd just put in a very boring Excel spreadsheet the years and where all the brothers were. And I worked out that the three brothers were only ever in the house together for 4 years. Two of those, Frank's 0 to 2 years old. And I showed this to Frank, and he was fascinated by it. He hadn't actually thought about it that way, that the distance in their relationship is really just to do with the circumstances. It's not anything to do with... So I think that kind of thing, he would have been interested in seeing himself in the biography. Frank didn't like talking about himself, but I worked out very quickly the best way to get him to talk about himself is to make him your research assistant, talking about Frank Morehouse as a subject. And that's when he would...
Almost in
the third person. So he could go, oh, this, you're not actually attacking me or talking to me. I don't feel vulnerable, but we're talking about what Frank did in the 80s or the 90s or this or the context. And that's when he'd bring out more information and more archival from his personal stash at home and go, well, here, this might be interesting. This might help. And so having him as a research assistant helped.
Mm.
That's what I kind of missed with the second volume, I think.
It strikes me, listening to that we all need a biographer, like a live-in biographer in real life, to help us join the dots of our own lives, which is actually what a lot of the experience of living is, isn't it? Trying to make the connections and work out what the patterns are.
Yep.
And then if you've got somebody who's doing that for you,
it helps.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Lam. Good luck with volume two. I can't wait to read it.
Cheers. I can't wait to finish it.
To learn more about and follow Matthew's work and workings, you can sign up to his Substack at Public Things.
You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Reese. And don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 via the website archivefeverpod.com. You can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen. Hey, give us a rating. We'd really love that.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
They're pretty resilient. The oldest specimen that we know of in our collection is about 500 years old.
Oh.
And it's in very good shape.
What is that and where does it come from?
It's an aquatic moss that we think is probably from Switzerland, kind of area. It doesn't have a locality on it, but we know it's from the herbarium of Caspar Bohan, who was a Swiss botanist.
Do we know how it came to be in Australia and
we
in this collection?
Do, yes. So Ferdinand Müller, in establishing the herbarium in Melbourne, was very keen. He wanted reference material from not only all around this continent, but from all around the world. Because if you're trying to understand the flora of a place, you need to do that in a global context, because the relationships between plants span continents. They ignore political boundaries that we impose on them.